KPFK and the Pacifica Foundation are going through profound changes. The network is being restructured. A new set of bylaws are being created. Pacifica will be democratized for the first time. The network is returning to its radical roots, seeking to determine who will be empowered to set its direction and who and what its programming will serve. Join us for KPFK Matters, a program to help you, the listener, participate in these changes. This Sunday, we'll take an in-depth look at Pacifica history, the crisis from which the network is emerging, and at why democracy at Pacifica is in your hands. Join us. Call in. KPFK Matters this Sunday at 10 a.m. on KPFK, Los Angeles.
System we get as a result, what we're getting more and more of, more concentrated, has distinctly negative implications for democracy. I mean, even if I said nothing more, just the fact that so few people control communication, even if they were the CEOs of those nine companies, the most wonderful people on earth, we've got the leading Gandhi expert in the world here, even if they make Gandhi look like a slime ball, these are the nine greatest humans who ever lived, ran those companies, it would be irrelevant. Having that much power and so few people, doesn't matter how good they are, what sort of people they are, it's just wrong in a democracy. Organized and accountable democratic public broadcasting service is something we have to deal with. It's a tough problem. But the one thing we know for sure, it can't be settled unless it's out in the open and we debate it. It's not going to be settled behind closed doors. And we can come up with a better system than the one we have. That much we know, too. Other countries have done a much better job.
Welcome to KPFK Matters, a special program mandated by the Interim Pacifica National Board on Pacifica's future, structure, and bylaws. My name is Rafael Renteria. For the next 2 hours, we'll be talking about the future of Pacifica Radio and your role in it. The first hour will provide history, background, and discussions about the process of democratization currently underway at the Pacifica Network. The second hour will be devoted entirely to unscreened listener call-ins. You'll have the chance to communicate directly with other listeners about what is most important to you in the making of a new Pacifica. Please stay tuned and join the conversation. In the signal areas of all five Pacifica stations, KPFK in Berkeley, WBAI in New York, KPFK in Southern California, KPFT in Houston, and WPFW in Washington, D.C., there have recently been a series of open meetings of bylaws committees made up of listener activists, national board members, local board members, station staff, and volunteers. The job of these committees is to make proposals as to what these bylaws should look like. Now, we are bringing to the airwaves this important discussion of how Pacifica will be remade. Joining us for today's discussion are Lynn Gary from New York, Jeff Blankford and Carol Spooner from the San Francisco Bay Area, David Adelson and Fernando Velasquez from Los Angeles. But first, we'd like to share with you some historical perspective about Pacifica's original structure from Matthew Lazar. Lazar is the author of Pacifica Radio, Rise of an Alternative Network, and is widely recognized as a leading authority on the early history of the Pacifica Network. In the following segment, Lazar describes the feelings of Pacifica founder Lewis Hill and his compatriots, who were pacifists and conscientious objectors, or COs, during World War II, and their outlook with respect to who would hold power at Pacifica.
When Lewis Hill got out of his CO camp, for a while he was the director of the National Committee on Conscientious Objectors for the American Civil Liberties Union, and then he left and went back to the San Francisco Bay Area, where he had been a student at Stanford before the war, and he began organizing the Pacifica Foundation. And when he did that, he started organizing, when he created this nonprofit in 1946, which he did, and when he began organizing to build a radio station somewhere in the San Francisco Bay Area. First he wanted it to be in Richmond, California, then he wanted it to be in Berkeley. He wound up settling for Berkeley, although that wasn't his first choice. He knew some things. He knew who his staff would be. They would mostly be pacifists and former COs who he had met or worked with or in some cases helped. He knew who his big financial backers would be. They would be liberals and Quaker pacifists who had lots of money and who were willing to help him out. And there was one group of people who he didn't know who they would be, and that was his listeners. And as a result of that, he didn't deal them into the governance structure of the Pacifica radio network. He and his pacifist friends were, in fact, distrustful of popular democracy. They had had the experience of being overwhelmingly marginalized by the Second World War. Most people in the United States supported the war against Hitler. My family supported the war against Hitler. I'm sure that if I had been alive at that time and of draft age, I would have done what my father did, which was gone into the army. Hill understood that his ideas would be, in time of war, extremely unpopular. And as a result, he was very distrustful of the idea of giving formal power within the governance of the organization to the people to whom he would broadcast. That if KPFA had gone on the air in 1939 rather than 1949, there's no question in my mind that by 1942, 1943, if KPFA was on the air preaching against the United States involvement in the Second World War and the listeners had been given the vote, they would have voted Hill out of office. Actually, that's probably, it probably wouldn't have even have come to that, because people probably would have dragged Hill out of the studio and beaten him up in the street for the things he thought about the Second World War. Today, we who have been critical of the United States bombing of Afghanistan find ourselves closer, I think, to the situation that Lewis Hill faced than at any other time in the history of the Pacifica Radio Network. During the Vietnam War, during various phases of the Cold War in the 1950s, the Pacifica Radio Network's critical stance towards the various wars of intervention which took place, which were executed by the United States, pretty much had the support of much of the left. If large portions of the American people didn't approve of them, large portions of the left did. But the left is in very great disarray over the bombing of Afghanistan and the and whatever it is that the Bush administration is going to do about terrorism. So that we really do find ourselves, we who have been critical of this war, in the same place that Lewis Hill found himself. Although I think it should be noted that the vast majority of people who are involved with Pacifica today are not pacifists. I think most Pacificans today are sympathetic on one level or another to pacifism, and certainly recognize the important role that pacifists have played in the movements for peace and social justice. And while there are still pacifists within the Pacifica Radio organization, no question in my mind, most people aren't. I think that if you surveyed most people, they would not tell you that they are pacifists. While they may question war, could we really say that many Pacificans during the late 1970s and early 1980s who supported the Nicaraguan Revolution were pacifists, or who supported the Cuban Revolution were pacifists, or who supported the Guatemalan or Salvadoran insurgents were pacifists? I think that while there's a core of people within Pacifica who remain, who continue to affiliate with the pacifist ideology, it's not like it was in the late 1940s and early 1950s, when most of the people who were associated with Pacifica governance were pacifists. Today, the organization is much, much larger and much more broadly dispersed among the progressive left, and it's a much bigger and much more complicated organization, both organizationally and ideologically, than it was then. And that's the reason why, in my opinion, the non-formal participation of the listener subscribers is an anachronistic practice at this point. Today, because the Pacifica Radio Network is so much more complicated and so much bigger than it was in Lewis Hill's day, we need a leadership which is seen as legitimate by a goodly portion of the organization. And the organization at this time doesn't have any system that produces that legitimate leadership. You have a lot of people, they're perfectly willing to tell you that they feel that they're legitimate. You know, you had Mary Frances Berry. Hi, I'm Mary Frances Berry. I'm with the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. I deserve to run Pacifica Radio. You have all these people who are willing, on the basis of their credentials, to represent themselves as the guiding force of Pacifica Radio. But when you say to them, well, who put you in charge of this? They don't have a good answer. What we need is we need to have a system of governance that resembles the values which we constantly hear on Pacifica Radio around governance everywhere else. And what you always hear on Pacifica Radio is that the world should be run more democratically.
That was Matthew Lazar, historian of Pacifica Radio, talking about Pacifica's governance in a recent interview with Heidi Chesney for Pacifica Matters, a listener-created program on the future of the Pacifica Network. In the years since its founding, Pacifica has grown into one of the largest non-commercial broadcasters in the U.S. Its signals can reach more than one in five American homes, and its broadcast licenses are valued at well over $300 million. Its annual budget is on the order of $12 million. Questions about who and what Pacifica will serve and how it will provide that service have been at the heart of the struggle over the direction of Pacifica in recent years. To understand the nature of this struggle, one needs to understand the changes that have taken place throughout community broadcasting in the U.S. Media historian and community radio activist Robert McChesney, professor of communications at the University of Illinois, addressed this topic in a speech he gave a year and a half ago.
The real culprit, in my view, is not technology, but what we call neoliberalism, a term I like to use a lot. It's a sort of an academic-y term, I know, but I think it really captures the essence of what's going on globally in the United States better than any other term. Back in the 30s, and even into the 60s, when I was coming of age, there used to be a term about fascism. Some of you might remember this term. They say, what's the difference between fascism and capitalism? They say, fascism is capitalism with the gloves off, meaning fascism is capitalism without democratic rights, without elections, freedoms. It's just pure, unadulterated capitalist power. Well, that's actually not true. We now know, and I think any careful look shows, that fascism is a far more complicated phenomenon than that. It's mass movements, all sorts of bigotry, racism. There's a whole lot of other stuff going on in fascism than just capitalism and naked class power. But neoliberalism is capitalism with the gloves off. That is exactly what neoliberalism is. It's a capitalism premised in the idea that the rich should rule the world. Whoever makes the most money win. Deregulate business, lower taxes, lessen the power, if not explicitly smash labor, turn everything that can possibly be made profitable over to the market to be subject to market principles, with a damn the torpedoes attitude towards the social consequences. Now, under neoliberalism in the United States and around the world, public service broadcasting survives, but not on principle, because there's no principled explanation for it now. It only survives due to political strength, because you can muscle up a lobby that listens to it that will fight for it. That's the case in the United States. That's the case in Germany and Britain and Scandinavia. On principle, it doesn't fit in at all. In fact, one of the great conflicts in Europe today is the European Union dealing with the fact that public service broadcasting violates all the free market principles they're trying to install as they put in a continental-wide market for their corporations. As the media companies are constantly complaining to the European Union, we have to compete with these guys who are being subsidized. Stop it. And they're saying, you're right. It's a real conflict there, and it's been a real tension there, because it's a square peg in a round neoliberal hole.
And indeed, the Gingrich Congress made serious attempts to defund public broadcasting and subject it to a market standard.
I am amazed what I just heard from this other side of the aisle. They said, we have to have government-subsidized broadcasting at taxpayers' expense to counter what you're hearing from the free enterprise system. That you have to have government to get out a public propaganda message instead of listening to what's on news programs or public information programs from free enterprise. That is a socialist approach. I reject it.
CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the public taxpayer-financed component of public broadcasting, will be gone by 98. All my amendment does is phase that cut in a way where they can make the adjustment easier than is otherwise prescribed under the legislation before us. It's a 33% cut. Instead of waiting until 97 and taking a 70% hit on their whole budget. It's history, guys. Open your eyes up. You know, we're talking about letting the private sector run it as it always should have.
Would the gentleman further yield?
Yes, indeed.
The gentleman is on the Ways and Means Committee, a great leader on that committee. Could the gentleman give us some idea of how much of tax write-off the commercial television stations get each year, how much the taxpayer subsidizes their operations?
Infinitely preferable to do it in the private sector than in the public sector.
But the gentleman did not answer my question.
These attempts at defunding ultimately failed due to the immense support for public broadcasting. But the activities of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, along with the threat of defunding, drove many community broadcasters further down the road toward using commercial means of audience development, such as target market programming to a specific core audience to maximize fundraising. At community stations across the country, moves were made to professionalize programming, as volunteerism and diverse radio formats were derided as wasteful of valuable resources, and programming for oppressed groups was dramatically cut. Along with this trend was a trend towards centralizing administrative control of community broadcasting and public radio professionals, and marginalizing listeners and volunteers from the decision-making process. Priorities shifted from providing a platform for a broad diversity of voices in the community to garnering larger and more affluent audiences. McChesney described the pressure on non-commercial broadcasters.
What evolves rationally in the United States in public broadcasting in this context, if you can only do the stuff that's not profitable and you're going to depend on viewers and listeners to bankroll you for whatever the percentage, 20 to 60% of your income, you sure aren't going to aim it at poor people. They can't give you any money. You pitch it to the upper middle class. It's a rational thing to do. Anything else would be suicidal if you're running a station. And so you have a station, a system, pitched at those who have disposable income who can give you money during pledge drives. Perfectly rational.
It may be perfectly rational to target the affluent, but Pacifica was created to serve a different logic. Pacifica was created to serve a specific mission. That mission, as reflected in its articles of incorporation, is to explore the causes of conflict in an attempt to create a more just and peaceful world by using dialogue and discourse to help bring an end to racism and war. The key questions, however, about how Pacifica is to serve its mission were kept off the table for discussion, and the arguments about the impacts of structural adjustment in community broadcasting were kept off the air. Most importantly, listener sponsors had no say about the direction of their stations. The common theme of the nationwide movement to restore Pacifica Radio was that the listener should be able to hear the discussions about Pacifica's future, to participate in them, and to be able to have an impact on Pacifica's direction and its programming. Will the rewriting of Pacifica's bylaws give listener sponsors a meaningful role? That's part of what we're here to talk about. Clips you heard from Robert McChesney come courtesy of Alternative Radio and can be found at www.alternativeradio.org. Joining us by telephone from New York is Lynn Gary, former KPFK shop steward and one of the founders of the movement to free Pacifica. From San Francisco, we are joined by Jeffrey Blankford, a founding member of Take Back KPFA and an activist in the movement to free Pacifica since its inception in the Bay Area. Jeffrey.
Yes.
Talk to us if you would. Good morning. How are you?
I'll let you have a tremendous toothache, but I'll carry on.
Okay, that's good. Talk to us if you would, Jeffrey, about the relationship between the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the United States Information Agency, the Voice of America, and their relationship with the CIA, and how those relationships may have contributed to the massive changes in recent years in the world of public radio and at Pacifica in particular.
Well, the direct connection, of course, is that Robert Coonrod, who became the president of the CPB, the Corporation Public Broadcasting, which was giving up annually with rough numbers about $1 million to Pacifica, had been the former deputy director of the Voice of America and had been in charge of Radio Marti, which of course was deeming U.S. propaganda to Cuba, and obviously had direct connections with the Central Intelligence Agency. It was ironic that Pat Scott, who as executive director was a major orchestrator of the what nearly was the destruction of Pacifica, when she chose to retire, was a recipient of a special press conference announcement by Robert Coonrod congratulating Pat on how she had brought Pacifica back into the mainstream. And it was ironic that this Pat, by her own admission, had been a former member of the Communist Party, but had not suffered any kind of red baiting when she had been back in Washington representing Pacifica as a lobbyist before that. The CPP's role, it has been a rather important one in non-commercial radio. In most instances, it's benign, but in the circumstances when you have a powerful instrument to communicate to the public like Pacifica, it has been anything but benign. And we see with the use of the Healthy Stations Project, which Lynn would go into more, but in terms of bringing Pat Scott and then Lynn Chadwick from the National Federation of Community Broadcasters onto a committees to decide how public stations should get funded, on how the vice president of the CPB, Rick Madden, used his influence in collaboration with Pat Scott and the present, still present, Pacifica lawyer firm of John Kriegler to intimidate the local advisor, the national board, rather, and members of our local advisory board up here and in Los Angeles in voting for a bylaw change back in 99, which would basically eliminate any kind of voice of the local radio station communities on the national board.
Okay, we'll pick that theme up in just a minute. Lynn, describe for us, if you could, the origins and development of what's called the Healthy Stations Project and Pacifica's strategic five-year plan to mainstream programming. And if you would, describe the impact of these plans at Pacifica and what you think might have been the roles and motives of the CPB in the development and execution of these plans.
Well, the Healthy Station Project actually was once again born out of the CPB under the name of the Blueprint Project. And it was a plan for getting public media to adopt the paradigms of commercial media. It was taken up by the National Federation of Community Broadcasters when it was under the leadership of Lynn Chadwick, who has played a large role in the whole Pacifica hijacking affair, and her husband, David LePage. It was called the Healthy Station Project. And Chadwick and LePage went around the country to community radio stations with money that had been given by the CPB to push this program. And essentially, the program was one that, in practicality, was to reformulate the relationship of community radio from what had been an understanding that a community radio station was really a social organization. It was a social unit that, through the medium of broadcasting, people engaged in, you know, if you will, active citizenship, for lack of a better term. The idea behind the Healthy Station Project, although it was not pitched that way, was to sever that holistic relationship and to impose the corporate paradigm, the professional paradigm, to turn the running of stations over to a paid cadre of professional managers, to relegate the listeners and the community to a position of consumers of a media product, and to encourage the elimination of the large panoply of volunteer producers that have been the hallmark of community radio and Pacifica Radio, which Pacifica broke the ground in that regard, and to replace it with something called strip programming, something all the way across the week, a single host paid And the justifications for this were professionalism, fiscal soundness, consistency of quality, but the political implications, which were not articulated when Chadwick and LePage went around the country to push this program, was that once again you would have a system where you could put that media voice in the control of a very few people whose livelihoods depended upon them, you know, say, catering to wealthy foundation donors, catering to target markets, minimizing anything that might be controversial and experimental as being too risky or outside of this very narrow creative box in terms of how radio was to be now presented.
That leads right
and
to my next question.
And you see, like, NPR, NPR is the model. The way that NPR is the model for what this Healthy Station Project was going to try to impose on all of the various independent community radio stations, of which the five Pacifica radio stations were perhaps the preeminent and oldest.
Lynn, in contrast with NPR and without question, the history of Pacifica demonstrates that the radical vision of programming that is embodied in the Pacifica mission has presented a threat to the powers that be. If you would, just in the briefest of terms, give us a sense of the kinds of attacks that Pacifica has faced in the course of its history from figures in the U.S. government.
Certainly. Pacifica has faced attacks from various quarters in the U.S. government almost since it went on the air in 1948. The earliest, as far as I know, and the most well-known were attacks from the whole constellation of the House Un-American Activities, McCarthy eras, committees. In the case of Pacifica, it was the Senate version of the House Un-American Activities Committee, the formal name of which escapes me at this present moment. Different people who were in the Pacifica administration were actually targeted because of their political affiliations. People were called to testify, and there was a lot of controversy in Pacifica. And alas, in fact, what happened at that time was one of the officials of the Pacifica Foundation was cut loose and made a sacrificial lamb by the others, who decided that it was better to cut him loose and not support his rights to hold certain political ideas in order to protect the whole foundation. And obviously, history can look at that. More recently, in the period that was alluded to in the cut with the issue of the Gingrich Congress, the defunding of public broadcasting, Pacifica was particularly made a scapegoat, and KPFK in particular, for having programming by black nationalists on the air. And this was taken in a... This is a very controversial issue still, I think, in Los Angeles, so I'll just touch on it lightly, that whatever the nature of the controversy, this was used as a weapon by the Republicans in that campaign to defund public broadcasting. Pacifica, in fact, KPFK, also came under attack for its gay and lesbian programming in the mid-'80s. For airing a program called The Jerker, and a religious fundamentalist minister who had been clearly monitoring the airwaves looking for a cause to bring a complaint, had charged that KPFK was broadcasting pornographic material. Pacifica ended up in a court case over this as well, over the issues of what could or could not be said on the air. I had to take it to the Supreme Court, as in fact had happened decades earlier in Pacifica's history at something that was centered around WBAI in New York, with a broadcast by the comedian George Carlin citing, as it were, seven words that you can't say on television. And as it turned out, you couldn't say those words on radio by the time the court cases were concluded. Now, interestingly enough, many times the things that got attacked were cultural programming, because to make an overt attack on the political content was so clearly unconstitutional that the cultural programming would be seized on. But I think the real goal was to silence the alternative and radical political perspectives that you could hear on Pacifica. And, you know, and they know that with an organization that exists in such a financially tenuous state, any kind of a court case at all can bankrupt an organization when you think, you know, Pacifica doesn't have spare amounts of $100,000 or $200,000 lying around to fight a constant series of what amount to slap suits by government and their, you know, collaborators in the private sector, their proxies, you know, say people in the religious right or what have you.
Thank you, Lynn. Jeffrey, in conclusion, the leading figures in the CPB, that would include, you know, Robert Coonrod, former head of the Voice of America, these guys played an important role in facilitating the illegal bylaws changes that made Pacifica's national board self-selecting and that effectively hijacked the network. Could you describe for us briefly the relationships between the players at Pacifica and the CPB at that juncture, at the particular juncture when the bylaws were overturned?
Lynn Chadwick was the executive director, and she had replaced Pat Scott. What Pat Scott had done, she had made a consistent effort within Pacifica to, first of all, eliminate any staff members from serving on the national board, any programmers from serving on the national board, and then to keep the local board from selecting any members of the local advisory board. And so she had gone to Coonrod. She had written a letter to Coonrod or spoken to Coonrod, and he had written back to her that her concern about the legitimacy of having local advisory board members serving on the national board was quite well taken. And so she referred this to Pacifica's lawyer at the time, and present lawyer, I should add, John Kriegler. And Kriegler, rather than challenging this, which could be challenged, as lawyers like Peter Frank on our side have said could be done, he wrote an opinion which, in fact, backed up the CPB's opinion. Then, even though the local advisory board, to get back to it, our local advisory board members here had promised had been committed to vote against the bylaw change that Scott was trying to have, Chadwick, now in Scott's position, was trying to push through, and along with Mary Frances Berry, and the two representatives from Los Angeles who had agreed, I believe, not to vote for this. At the very last minute, a letter was sent by Rick Madden informing Pacifica that if they did not overthrow or change the bylaws and eliminate the local advisory board members from serving at the same time the national board, Pacifica would lose its funding. And so these lab members, under pressure, not politically sophisticated, bowed to that, did not want to be responsible for losing the Pacifica's money. And so they voted to approve this bylaw change. But what was really significant is what CPB had done before this, is when, in 1995, when I had been barred from attending a Pacifica board meeting and kicked out of one that was supposed to be a public meeting in Houston, an investigator for the CPB, Brian McConville, who was number three ranking at the CPB Inspector General's office, had read an article in the Current newspaper, which is the house organ of public radio, that there was this dispute and that I had been kicked out of this meeting, and there were questions about this, and so he launched an investigation into Pacifica. 17 days later, he was told to clean out his desk and was fired. He had a perfect job record up to that point. I and Take Back KPFA contacted Pacifica complaining about various violations of federal communication regulations concerning open meetings. We got no response. We filed a formal complaint with the CPB. The deputy director of the CPB, a man named Michael Donovan, looked at our complaint, and he came to the conclusion in a conversation I had with him in December of 1996 that Pacifica had indeed violated numerous open meeting laws and meeting and notices of meetings, and that he wanted to get a report out within the month, by the end of January, before the funding period, because he said Pacifica had really done a very bad job. And so I waited until the end of the month, and we called him. I called him to find out what had happened to the report. He had also been fired. And I could not, and still to this day, have not been able to find out what happened to him. So here we have Pacifica practices being defended by a government organization. Finally, they, under pressure from us, they did appoint a new inspector general. He did make a report. The report also found Pacifica had made numerous violations. I went back to testify at the CPB board meeting. I walked into the board meeting. The inspector general, who had come out to interview myself and others out here, told me that the fix was in, that his report was going to be whitewashed completely. And sure enough, it was. I went in there, and they had already made a statement, written a statement out, saying that the inspector general had given a clean bill of health to Pacifica, when in fact, this wasn't true. This really shows a collusion between the Corporation of Public Broadcasting and Pacifica in so many significant instances, two firings in this report, that the conclusion that I drew, have drawn and others have drawn, that the attack on Pacifica, what it was, was a government operation.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you, Lynn. Please stay with us on the line for the call-ins a little bit later. We really appreciate your involvement. Joining us now are Fernando Velasquez and Lorraine Mirza, both former producers of news and public affairs programming at KPFK. Under the regime of Pacifica's hijackers, both Fernando and Lorraine were banned from this radio station. Lorraine, we've been discussing Pacifica's discussing Pacifica's strategic five-year plan to mainstream programming. What was the impact of that plan at KPFK?
First of all, I do want to say that I was at the very first five-year plan meeting that was called by Lynn Gary, whom we've heard earlier. And I actually took minutes for that meeting in my little Toshiba computer. And at that meeting, all of us at that time were led to believe it was just going to be the same political programming and the same alternative programming, but all we were doing and aiming for was a better sound, better quality, and more professional presentation of the same politics. So many of us thought this was great. We did want to see things done better and to sound better. And so we went along with it at first, and so we attended these meetings. We were told that our input, and there was about 20, maybe 20 of us in the room at the time, or 15 of us, we were told very clearly that we would set some guidelines for the new up-and-coming five-year plan. And so we brainstormed, and we did it, and we presented what came out of that meeting. But what came back to us a few weeks later was a totally different scheme.
And Lorraine, what was the impact at KPFK?
The impact at KPFK was, of course, the beginning to purge programmers, particularly programmers of color, radical programming, programming that did not fit the nice and right, a more right, more central scheme of things. Programming, many programmers, they began in 1994 all the way through 95 to purge people and to turn, for example, the first and to turn into like the strip programming. I remember the morning program. We had a wonderful magazine program with Ariana, Manoff. And that program was removed, and they put on something called Up for Air, which was just a very poorly done clone of an NPR morning lineup. And these things began, and programming, of course, was the most affected.
Okay. Thank you, Lorraine. Fernando, tell us briefly about the affirmative action proposal that was recently mandated by the Interim Pacifica National Board and the relationship of that plan to revising Pacifica's structure and bylaws and the need for diversity at KPFK in Pacifica.
Well, first of all, I must say that it was an effort by a number of a diverse group to get together and spend a couple of days talking about the need to be more inclusive, Pacifica to be more inclusive, and then Pacifica National Board decided to, yes, take it as a working document. But in my opinion, it needs to go further than that. You know, the listeners need to address, realize that if they want to truly live up to the Lou Hill's mission, instead of paying lip service to it, they need to incorporate people, give the microphone, give the airwaves to people of color, not just to invite them every now and then and give them 2 or 3 minutes or 7 minutes in a program. That's one thing. The other one is that the Healthy Station Project that caters to the rich, no different than the Democrats and the Republicans doing an electoral campaign, trying to sell themselves to the best buyer, and that in terms of Pacifica to only cater to the people who have money. Latinos are the most exploited people, but they have very bad salary. How can they get money to give to Pacifica? Black people, those who are not in prison, are unemployed, and those who have jobs are underpaid. So where are they going to get money to pay to Pacifica? So the Native Americans, never mind, they're the worst off in their own land. So how can this affirmative action be implemented? By being conscious, having a serious analysis and debate of what's going on, and really incorporating all the people who have been left out.
In your view, Fernando, how can Pacifica both fulfill its mission in programming to serve oppressed groups while still maintaining a viable financial base?
Well, number one, not to pay lip service to Lou Hill's mission and really go into the anti-war. We have very few seconds to speak, so we have to speak a little faster, otherwise we're going to run out of time. To really live up to the mission of being anti-war, not just pacifist, but also anti-war, to take a head-on encounter with the military-industrial complex and realize that during the Cold War and now with the war on terrorism, all it means is just exploiting the natural resources of the global South for the privilege and the luxury of the people of the global North. So that's one way. And the other one is to be inclusive and to bring people of color, bring the exploited people, not just anybody with color with the proper last name, but to bring the right people to speak of their own things and stop labeling nationalism every time somebody of color talks about their issues. And when white Eurocentric nationalism is promoted, it's okay because it's normal. That's our thing. So this is serious self-criticism needs to take place. And that probably will be, if you're inclusive and address people's issues and where they feel impassionate that the KPFK is truly representing their interest, I think people of color will come in with their money instead of buying safe soft drinks or beer or whatever things they buy with their money. They will start giving it to Pacifica, and Pacifica will be a new Pacifica with more money than Pacifica has now.
I hope we're able to get further into these questions when we have
I hope
call
so too.
Very much so. Joining us now by telephone from Santa Rosa, California, is Interim Pacifica National Board member Carol Spooner. Carol Spooner was the lead plaintiff in what's called the listener's lawsuit against the former Pacifica National Board. And she also heads up the Bylaws Revision Committee of the Interim National Board. Also with us in the studio is David Adelson, former chair of the KPFK Local Advisory Board and lead plaintiff in the Adelson versus Pacifica suit, the first of several lawsuits against the former Pacifica National Board. Carol Spooner, hi, how are you?
Hi, good morning, Raphael.
Good to talk to you. Carol, Pacifica has been in a period of profound crisis. What has been the nature of that crisis, and how is it rooted in Pacifica's original structure?
Well, this crisis, as you've been hearing, has been going on for quite a long time, and it's morphed several times. I will talk about what I know best, which is what has happened since 1999. In 1999, shortly after the bylaws were changed in February of 99 to eliminate any local board representation on the national board, the general manager at KPFA was fired at the end of March of 99. This set off great deal of consternation inside the system because she was the first good manager they'd had in years, and led to on-air discussion of this issue and people being fired. And eventually, armed guards were brought into the station, and it was really put under military rule. And the station was closed down for 23 days and occupied by armed guards. At that time, Dave Adelson filed the first lawsuit on behalf of members of the local boards around the country, protesting, objecting to the bylaws amendments. Shortly after that, I went to the California Attorney General seeking standing to sue on behalf of listeners, alleging that the board needed to be removed for breach of trust, and that the bylaws were totally illegal, that we needed to have a membership foundation so that the board of directors would be accountable to the listeners and the staff. That was in 99, and it took until December of 2001 to settle all of those lawsuits. In the meantime, the hijacking continued and got worse and worse and worse. The executive director of 99, Lynn Chadwick, resigned under pressure. A new executive director, Bessie Wash, came in, who, if anything, was worse. And they began squandering the foundation assets, our money, in just such a profligate manner that by the time we got the foundation back at the end of 2001, the Pacifica Foundation was functionally bankrupt. We had more debt than we had cash to pay by about $4.8 million. So they had looted the foundation, spent money on all kinds of things, lawyers that should have been paid by their insurance, public relations agencies, private investigators to investigate all of us. They squandered all kinds of money.
I want to turn to David Adelson for a second. David, how did the old Pacifica National Board's revision of the bylaws impact the movement of Free Pacifica? How did it result in your lawsuit against the old Pacifica National Board, and what were the terms of your lawsuit?
Well, first of all, it wasn't my lawsuit. It was brought by 20 members from four of the five station local advisory boards, although I did do a lot of the organizing work on it. For, and as people have been hearing, for a number of years, there were some fairly substantial changes going on at Pacifica, a major reconfiguration. And people who disagreed with that reconfiguration were shown the door. I want to say that what was happening at Pacifica was something that had happened throughout non-commercial broadcasting since at least the mid-1980s. The problem was, when these changes were happening, there was no way to communicate to the listeners what was going on. So, for example, although Z Magazine carried some stories on it, there was not broad understanding of the nature of these changes. And when somebody gets on the radio and says everything's wonderful and we're going to be more effective and more professional, and indeed I think we have to recognize that the claims that KPFK was still more progressive than anything on the air is indeed accurate. So there wasn't widespread understanding of I see you shaking your head. I think it depends on one's perspective very much. But in any case, there are people who I'm certain are listening right now who would consider that that was the case. But in any case, it was impossible to communicate to a substantial audience the fact that these changes were going on, and really the important content of those changes as they related to the way decisions got made towards what Pacifica's resources were being directed. And one thing that was always said was, well, this new regime had produced Democracy Now, and see what a hard-hitting, excellent program that was. That was really what they were all about. The issue, I think of it really as a kind of a privatization. And the change in bylaws was really a change that allowed the National Board to control its own membership for the first time in its history. Previously, a majority of board members had been elected by the local boards.
And they became self-selecting or self-appointing.
They became self-selecting or self-appointing.
To the exclusion of others.
Correct. It meant that, see, there were a number of people on the local advisory boards who had, over time, become more and more distressed by what was going on, the lack of input, the lack of consensus, the removal of people, and the rest of it. So in any case, when the change in bylaws occurred, it became very clear that that was essentially a transfer of corporate ownership. And it's funny, because a lot of people on the left who you would talk to about these things couldn't understand them, but when I talked to anybody in the corporate world, they understood the idea of a corporate takeover very clearly. It was very straightforward. So that's something also that the courts understand very clearly. And in fact, California Corporations Code say that you cannot remove the voting rights of members of a corporation without their consent. And anybody who had voting rights for directors is by definition a member of the foundation. So in any case, the lawsuits prevented them from continuing with the radical makeover of the irreversibility of the makeover of Pacifica. They had to deal with the fact that they had just done something illegal. And even though they moved ahead with the things that Carol described, the lockout at KPFA, there was a memorandum from then-Treasurer Michael Palmer discussing the sale of KPFA. And we believe that the point of that was to fund the five-year plan, basically have paid programmers throughout the network running off of the incredible asset value of the two signals that were in the commercial part of the spectrum. But in any case, those lawsuits kept them in place and didn't allow them to complete these plans, while a burgeoning nationwide movement came to understand what was going on, and I think that was crucial.
Dave, what are bylaws and what does it mean in terms of Pacifica's mission and programming and in terms of its daily function to revise bylaws?
Well, bylaws are the corporate constitution, and nonprofit corporate boards of directors have immense powers, more less oversight, less reporting requirements than any publicly held corporation. So the bylaws are the constitution, and they define how the governing body of the institution is selected and what powers they have. They may or may not, when we get through with this process, define what roles people have in determining programming. That's something that's up in the air, and that's one of the things that needs to get discussed in this bylaws process. But basically, the bylaws are the constitution, and we're going to be talking about the way in which the control of governance impacts on what happens at the stations, because it's not a direct or obvious link necessarily.
Carol Spooner, what process has been set up to revise Pacifica's bylaws?
Well, the National Board, I should say that as a result of the legal settlement, we are under a court mandate to revise our bylaws by the end of this and hold elections for local boards by the end of this year and elections for the National Board by the end of next March in 2003, pursuant to the new bylaws. At the March meeting of the National Board, we decided that we would set up subcommittees in each of the five station areas that would meet and brainstorm and try to get as many ideas on the table about how to restructure Pacifica as possible. And that is still going on, actually. These subcommittees have been meeting, people have been bringing ideas forward, there's been discussion and debate and so forth. At the last meeting of the board, which was June 21st, 22nd, and 23rd, the board decided that what we would do next would be to try to synthesize the ideas that were on the table and put out a draft of some proposed bylaws, or perhaps two drafts, for review and comment. That's underway right now. Rob Robinson, who has been the co-chair of the Washington, D.C. subcommittee, is working on a draft, and I am working on a draft. Those drafts will come out for review and comment. They will be in some ways different and in some ways the same. So those drafts will then come out in the subcommittees, and they will be posted also on the Pacifica website for public comment. And then we're going to need to get, under the legal settlement, at least three of the five local station boards to agree on two matters in the bylaws, which are the number and manner of election of local boards, a number of members, and the number of members and manner of election of the national board. We hope to be able to get that done by September. I don't know if we really can, but that's the target date. So we are trying to get that done.
And Carol, who is empowered to ratify the bylaws?
Well, as I said, under the legal settlement, the local boards have to ratify, at least three of the five local boards have to ratify those two areas of the bylaws. The rest of the bylaws, and including those two areas, need to be approved by a two-thirds vote of the current interim board of directors. So the bylaws will actually be decided in their final form by the interim board and the local boards.
A number of listeners in the KPFK bylaws subcommittee have posed the question that this might not be a fully democratic process. How would you respond to that?
It isn't. It is not a fully democratic process. Definitely not. That's unfortunate. We don't have a mechanism now in place for all of our listeners to vote. That's what the bylaws, I hope, will create, will be a democratic organization where our members will have voting rights. But right now, we don't have them. So the local and national boards will be in a position to make these decisions. So it's kind of a chicken and egg story.
Carol, one of the points that I've been making in that meeting is that because you do need to establish the process by which local boards and national boards receive a true mandate, those boards, once they're selected, are perfectly capable of going back and altering the bylaws
precisely
as they
so.
See fit by a process that's defined in the bylaws. So this is not the Constitution for all time immutable.
Exactly
so it so. Is a stepwise process towards some kind of democratic governance. And I just want to end with the concept that we don't know how well a democratically run media organization of the size of Pacifica is going to work. But one of the things we're really hoping is to get your calls and get listener involvement in this process, because without that involvement, the term democratic doesn't actually mean very much.
And we're getting ready to open the phone lines in just a moment. The call-in number is 818-985-KPFK. That's 818-985-5735. We're going to turn now, and I want to thank Carol and I want to thank David, and ask you please to hang on with us for the listener call-ins in just a few moments. But we're going to turn now to a report from Margalo Ashley Ferrand, a member of the KPFK Bylaws Subcommittee, who will offer us a brief update on the work of that subcommittee and some of the conclusions its members have drawn regarding listener power and the future structure of Pacifica. Margalo?
Good morning to all. KPFK's committee has been meeting since late March, early April. It's an open committee made up of listener activists meeting weekly to prepare our proposals for changes. We'll need to turn in those changes to the interim board within the approximately next 6 weeks so that they can be finalized in early fall. To date, there have been some statements of principle made and also some specific bylaws items voted on. One of the major statements of principle that has been made by the committee is that affirmative action regarding class, race, ethnicity, and gender shall be criteria for the makeup of the local station governing boards and for the national board. But we will be defining this further in future meetings. Another understanding has been that there will be elected local governing boards and that all elected positions will be subject to recall. Specific items that have already been voted into our proposal are that Pacifica shall be changed to become a membership corporation under California Corporations Code 5056. This permits members to vote on bylaws changes. That membership categories shall include subscribers, volunteers at the station, hardship, that is those unable to either contribute or work, and contributors to the plaintiffs in the recent lawsuits. Members must agree in writing to support, uphold, and promote the Pacifica mission. And this probably would be done by signing up for membership on a card where that's written. Members of a station area shall elect both their local board and the area's national board members. Now, on this, we had two proposals approved, so we need further discussion on them. One proposal was that there would be a direct election of the members for both the local board and also for the national board. The second proposal was that there would be a direct election for the local board, but that for the national board, there would be a direct election for half of the station's assigned members, and the other half would be appointed by our elected local board. The committee also agreed that finances shall be open and posted monthly at the national and station levels. The committee agreed that there should be an elected program council at each station, but we need to have further discussion on whether that program council should be part of the local governing board or should be a separate council. Then there are some other items that we need to discuss and have not yet done so. Although there's an understanding that there should be local governing boards, we've not yet addressed the section of bylaws to put forward those details. I hope that people who are listening to the show will join us, come to our meetings, and help us in making our proposals.
You're listening to KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM. For those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to KPFK Matters, a Pacifica National Board mandated discussion regarding the democratization of Pacifica. Tune in next week at this time to hear the regularly scheduled programs for these hours. For the last hour, we've been joined by Lynn Gary, Jeff Blankford, Fernando Velasquez, Carol Spooner, David Adelson, Lorraine Mirsa, discussing the development of the crisis at Pacifica and the restructuring of the network. Now, it's your turn. The phone lines are open. The call-in number is 818-985-KPFK. That's 818-985-5735. Callers will be free to make a comment or to ask a question. We ask you to try to keep it brief. The panelists will be happy to respond to your remarks, and you'll be given a chance to respond in turn to the panelists. The phone lines are open. Your calls are unscreened, so pick up the phone and give us a call. 818-985-5735. Actually, the lines are all full right now. Panelists, please be sure to keep your responses sharp, to keep them brief, to keep them to the point. Listeners, please show the same courtesy. Our goal is to facilitate as many listener calls as possible in the next hour. Again, you're listening to KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM. Let me brought to you by Xerox and four parts without commercial interruption. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from the Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia.
You're tuned to 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles. KPFK 90.7 FM and Todos Sonidos presents our music.